I got really a lot of sense knocked into me in Syria. That was the first time I really thought I was going to die. And it was the first time I really felt fear that was all encompassing. I think psychiatrists nowadays call it existential dread, which of course I didn't know the phrase back then, but that was the first time I experienced that. And I don't recommend it for anyone.
That was the voice of Jane Ferguson, award-winning journalist and author of the new memoir, No Ordinary Assignment. And I'm Martin Nutty.
And I'm John Lee. Welcome to our latest Global Irish Nation conversation here on Irish Stew. This episode of Irish Stew is sponsored by the Irish Heritage Tree Program. Celebrate your Irish roots by planting native trees for family and friends in the beautiful Golden Vale of Ireland. Go to irishheritagetree.com and use the exclusive discount code today. It's IrishStew10 for 10% off. That code again is IrishStew and the numeral 10. Keep the heritage of Ireland green and growing by going to irishheritagetree.com.
Hey, everybody. This is Martin Nutty on the Irish Stew podcast. Delighted to be back on again with my wonderful co-host, John Lee. John, tell us what's coming up.
Well, thank you, Martin. Good to be back here with you and with our listeners and with our guests today. Today is 9/11, a very significant day in so many ways, and particularly significant today as we have as our guest award-winning journalist Jane Ferguson, author of the riveting new memoir, No Ordinary Assignment. Jane grew up in the sectarian violence of the Troubles in rural County Armagh in Northern Ireland, spent most of her life reporting on the greater global troubles in Yemen, Somalia, Sudan, Iraq, Gaza, Syria, Afghanistan, where she stayed until the very bitter end as Kabul fell around her. Reporting for CNN International, Al Jazeera, PBS NewsHour, The New Yorker, and other outlets, and always finding the human stories in human wars. Probably the least surprising part of her memoir, No Ordinary Assignment, is when we read that she won the George Polk Award, an Emmy Award, and the Alfred I. DuPont Columbia Award. Jane is largely off the road now. We're speaking to her in New York City as she's about to catch a train down to Princeton University to teach a course there while continuing as a PBS NewsHour special correspondent and contributor for The New Yorker. Jane, we are so thrilled to have you join us here on Irish Stew.
I'm very happy to be here. Thank you.
We'll get into a lot of aspects of the book, and we've had authors before, and we want to hear about their book, but we also want to hear about their lives. You neatly combine both of these in one assignment because the book is really your life told in riveting and brutally honest terms. In the center of your book, there's a section of photographs, and I found that especially meaningful as your stories were told not just with words, but with pictures. But instead of looking at the snapshots from the world's hottest hotspots, there's a photo of you on the first page of photos as a gleefully happy young girl in County Armagh with your flat cap about to fall down over your face, held in place only by your government-issued glasses, holding the reins of a big, rugged, muddy horse on a farm in Market Hill, Northern Ireland. Why this shot? What does it mean to you?
I shared that shot actually a few years back on social media. And I think I said at the time, you know, like, I don't think any picture kind of more perfectly captures my kind of like young hillbilly childhood, because it really is. I mean, it really is sort of an image that it captures so much of what it was like to grow up on a small farm. I think there's a lot of very idealized versions of what it must be like and how romantic it must be to be on a farm. And I think that it sort of captured that little tiny person's spirit. You know, I just loved the picture. I loved how unglamorous it is. And I am utterly and completely oblivious to this fact. I know nothing about class politics at this stage. I know nothing about the world and corporate media. And I'm just smiling and holding a horse that was called Del Boy. And I remember it very clearly.
I was actually going to start off by saying, do you remember the horse's name? I was afraid maybe you didn't, so that's perfect. And you mentioned idyllic. There's that scene, idyllic, and then you hadn't really figured out what was going on around you, where you're trotting down the road on your pony, which is like, as a kid, just sounds like the greatest thing possible, until you encounter the British troops fully armed along the road. So the reality comes pretty quickly in your book.
Yeah, you know, it's a strange kind of duality, because there is a certain idyllic nature to the countryside, and then there's this. I was always struck as a kid. I just had this sense that there was something that wasn't quite right. You know, that there would be moments of incredible tension, and like I really wanted to dive into in the book. It's something people just didn't really talk about. And so, you know, when things like that would happen, it would just not really be discussed, you know, and it was just sort of like you would mention it. But on the one hand, it was life like that was passed off as totally normal. And I reflect on this in the book about how I see kids all over the world in various conflict zones, much bloodier conflict zones than Northern Ireland, but nonetheless, still places at war. And everything becomes so completely normal to them. But at the same time, there's also this sort of real sense of tension and the sense that idyllic moments can be broken at any moment. You know, you can't kind of rely on things, that there is a chaos that will rear its head again and you will never know when.
Jane, it's interesting. We've had other guests on, unsurprisingly, from Northern Ireland, and they kind of talk about the normalcy of the backdrop of the Troubles. Because they knew nothing else from both sides of the political divide. But you described the tension, obviously, that was there, that was kind of like the hum in your background. But that wasn't the only source of tension. And you kind of go into detail, rather brutally frank detail, about your family situation. So you describe your mother as having, I would suppose, anger issues and those being directed at you. I wonder now, after all these decades, looking back and being somewhat removed from that, how have you come to terms and understanding that difficulty?
Well, I think writing the book was a big part of it. You know, I set out at the very start of the book that I very much so wanted to come to understand, to be honest about and understand myself. And why do people do this kind of work? And as I connected the dots backwards and backwards over the years, you know, working and thinking about it and writing about it and really meditating on it, like, you know, what is it that makes us who we are? And, you know, it really, really does come back in so many cases. It comes back to various formative moments in your life, but also more broadly, your childhood, your sense of self and your sense of how you exist in the world around you. I think as a kid, I look back now and I recognize what's been interesting since the book has come out is the amount of people who have approached me and said, I had a very, very similar experience as a child. And I look back and realize that I think women at the time, especially in rural communities, I don't think they had a lot of opportunity to, A, live their lives with as many options as you know, obviously, as women like me, as their kids did. I think that very much so frustrated a generation of women. I don't think that we have been in the past, certainly in 1980s and 1990s, Ireland and Northern Ireland, being very well versed on communication, emotional health, how to take care of ourselves. So I think that these things manifest inside homes. And one thing that was sort of frightening about writing the book was that I felt like I was sort of breaking a taboo talking about it, because it's kind of shocking to talk about it. In some ways, I feel as though people are more shocked that I've written about it than that it happened. And so, because of course, it's very, very common. And I think that by talking about it, I've sort of, you know, essentially brought out in my own life how much it does actually shape us. And it was important to the conversation about war reporting. Because part of what I really wanted to write about in the book, what I really was trying to articulate along with my own story, is that many, many of us, people wonder what it is that creates us. And the reality is, I haven't done a scientific study, but I've been in the field for many years. The reality is that, you know, there are quite a few unhappy childhoods out there. And I mean that in a good sense, in the sense that people who have found that they have certain strengths and certain abilities to cope under pressure, under heightened anxiety, and people who have found that when they don't really fit in, that's perfectly okay. You can make a living out of that.
Jane, we're really, we want to touch a little bit more on the troubles in Northern Ireland and your experience of them. We're very interested when we learned you came from a Protestant family. We've had a few Republican, I guess, voices on in the past. The stories seem remarkably similar to the stories you're telling, the people who grew up in this and felt it was normal. But could you share, and also in your book, you seem to have such a clear-eyed view of the sectarian conflict from both sides. And that does seem to be reflected in your reporting later on. Tell us a little bit about the Protestant rural experience and what your life was like and when you began to realize things weren't exactly as they should be.
It's funny. I really tried to capture it in the book, what it, you know, the nuances. And a lot of people ask me, a lot of people say, you know, were you shaped by the troubles because of the violence around you? And I've often said yes, to a certain extent. You know, I mean, I did, you know, witness violence, explosions and bombings, and there were shootings. But most of it happens kind of, you know, in the shadows or not necessarily in front of your face. And I always say that the thing that really, really stuck with me as a journalist from my childhood was more growing up in a sectarian society, this incredibly divided society. And to think that it's normal, I mean, it really was divided, Protestants and Catholics, and different neighborhoods, different grocery stores, different pubs, different schools. That shocks people, right? You know, when you tell them that it was very, very uniform. But the added layer to all of this, and I certainly felt that within my Protestant community growing up, was that there was also kind of a denial about it. You know, like there was so much that we just did not talk about, and so much where it was, attitudes were presumed. And so there was never really debate about politics. There was just identity. And that's what it was. Now, there were people with varying extremes, you know, and I talked about that, you know, within families, like, you know, some people would be in the armed services. Other people, you know, would shy away from that. And I think that, so I think other than like the varying degrees of identity, there wasn't really much like politics discussed. And it felt very, very much so like we had to, you know, everything had to just sort of relatively be accepted as it was. But I was an incredibly inquisitive kid. You know, I asked questions all the time. I was constantly pushing back. I was pretty rebellious. Like I didn't understand until I got into like my teen years and started reading more of the history and starting to really understand Irish history. And I think that was sort of a little bit like breaking free from an identity that you're kind of assigned at birth in many ways, a political identity in Northern Ireland.
It strikes me that, you know, the childhood you described, books were your refuge. And then, of course, your book is dedicated to Fanny Marr, who seemed to be an extraordinary person and a refuge from, let's call it, a difficult childhood. And she was inspirational. So talk to us a little bit about Fanny and her role in your life.
Sure. Well, I had technically a great uncle, a distant relative, but I was pretty close to him and his wife. And he had a small horse farm in Armagh, but it was pretty close to, not too far from the border. And I used to spend a lot of time up there. And his wife, my Aunt Elsie, had a best friend. And that was Aunt Fanny, who basically became an honorary aunt in my life. And to the family. And she had no kids. She'd never married, but loved kids, was very, very happy having kids come and stay at her beach house. She had a little, she bought a fisherman's cottage that was almost tumbled down completely in the 1960s out on Tara Bay, which was just across from Strangford Lough on the other side of the peninsula. It was really, really a stunning, still is a stunningly beautiful part of the world. But she had a house in Belfast. Interesting, like her family had a really interesting history. Her father had been a senior boss at Harland and Wolff years back, and I think like chief accountant or something like that. And Fanny had worked in business, and her brother had owned businesses. And to me, I had no women in my life who lived that kind of life, who weren't married, didn't have kids, owned their own home, two of them, and traveled the world. And she was cultured and she was funny. She used to chain smoke cigarettes and drink whiskey in the evening. She was just the most like alive person, the warmest person, avid reader. She really brought a lot of the wider world into my life. And she was someone for whom, that identity, that mantle of like, this is who you are when you're born. Like it was just didn't seem to capture her at all. She was pretty extraordinary. At the time, she was the closest thing I'd ever had to someone who was deeply like, cosmopolitan, but she was also so warm, and her house to me became just a refuge. I would end up spending my summers at her beach house, at her little like farmer's cottage, a fisherman's cottage that she had done up. And she would organize all other kids in the neighborhood to come and play with me. And she would arrange for me to go out fishing with the fishermen. She would organize treasure hunts. We would play Scrabble in the evenings. So I would get better with my words and my vocabulary. She really was an extraordinary person. And she talked to me all the time. She just showed me an extraordinary amount of kindness. And we stayed in touch over the years. She passed away, unfortunately, in the early years of my career. I'd just been working in the field for a few years. But as I write in the book, Fanny not only showed me that love as a kid and really made me feel that self-worth that I think is really important for kids to feel. But then when I got out of college and I was a bit lost, I didn't quite know what to do. I'd sort of been spat out the other end of the education system where I'd always done well. I was a super academic kid, but I'd graduated into the financial crisis. It was 2007, 2008. It was media was collapsing. And I'd been working at the student newspaper. I'd loved it. All I'd ever wanted to do was be a journalist. And I was ready to get going. And newspapers were shuttering. I mean, it was impossible to get a job. I was lucky enough to get an internship at the BBC in Belfast. But I just couldn't really get any kind of real job in the door. And so one day Fanny wrote me a check. It was about £3,000. And she said, go off and spend this on something fun. She had been advised by her lawyer to start giving away her money because she didn't have any kids. And as she was sort of getting her estate in order, she didn't want to lose it all to inheritance taxes. And so every year she would find a few people who needed, who could benefit from this, and she'd write them a check and just send it to them. That's the kind of person she was. And that money I took and I flew to Yemen to study Arabic. And that was the start of 15 years in the Middle East.
So it sounds like your idea of fun would not match up with a lot of kids out of college handed £3,000.
Well, it was certainly an adventure.
Yeah, and as I understand it, your choice of Yemen seemed to be somewhat arbitrary, something to do with the sound of an oud playing on a website. But beyond that, I can't say until I read this book that I knew a huge amount about Yemen. Obviously, I was aware that the war was going on, but the scale of that country and its extraordinary history was hidden to me. And you bring that out in your book. You're talking about a country with 38 million people. And the other thing that strategically it's so important because it's at the bottom of that Saudi Arabian peninsula. It has a 1,200 mile coastline. So this is a big place. And its capital is located up, high in this incredible elevation. And you write, I can already get a sense of the beauty of the place before, of course, it descends into this maelstrom of madness. The one other thing I would say was, as a journalist, I assumed you went there because it was the home of the bin Laden family and you were trying to kind of dig that up,
Honestly, I didn't even know that at the time. Like I was just looking for the most exotic and interesting and away from here place I could think of. And it looked incredible to me. And it was totally immersive. And it's funny, you're quite right to use the word arbitrary. Like you know, when you're that age, I mean, how much time do you really spend thinking through your decisions in life? You know, I thought it sounded amazing. The oot, the pictures of the city, it sounded incredible. And also, you know, a lot of kids went at the time who wanted to study Arabic would go to Beirut or Damascus or Cairo. And to be quite frank, a lot of those places were just a lot more expensive. And I had this one pot of money and I wanted to make it stretch as far as possible. I mean, I was so lucky I did. You know, I went to Yemen and just it was the most immersive and transformative experience.
Jane, we like to travel in sequence here, but I do want to dip back on something that we missed. And, you know, I was trying to imagine the culture shock of going from, you were the UK at the time, to Yemen. What about the culture shock a few years earlier of traveling from County Armagh to Lawrenceville?
Yeah.
One of the most prestigious, beautiful, high-end prep schools in America. Which was a bigger culture shock? Lawrenceville or Yemen?
Certainly, Lawrenceville was a much bigger culture shock socially. It was, I guess it was more overwhelming because Yemen, at least, I was expecting it and I could sort of slowly come to learn it. And also the Yemeni culture is so welcoming of foreigners. Not that, you know, I mean, Americans are just as welcoming, but Yemenis kind of, we were so different that like it was almost easier to sort of understand one another from that distance. But when I got to Lawrenceville, I mean, it really was quite hard to describe. And I don't actually think I did as good a job as I would have liked in the book, like understanding it. That chapter was way longer. And my editor at HarperCollins at Mariner, she was chopping it up because it was slowing the book down. It was like, look, you know, we got to get on into your career, because I was trying to articulate exactly what you're saying. I mean, the culture shock was incredible. Everybody was absolutely lovely, very warm. In some ways, that was a little bit of a culture shock because we are, you know, certainly in Northern Ireland, I feel like we're very friendly people, but we're quite reserved. You know, this was the land of like bear hugs from strangers and, you know, and a lot of kindness and people showing up at your door with, you know, brownies they baked for you in case you're homesick. You know, people were absolutely like really unbelievably lovely. But it was one of the most affluent, it still is one of the most incredible schools in America, in the world. And this was an incredible opportunity for me. The culture shock was massive and it kind of stayed for the whole year. I just got better at building that muscle of just kind of, you know, going with it. But it was huge, you know. It's East Coast America, so everyone's very intense. You know, these kids, you make it onto the field hockey team, you practice 5 days a week. You play two games a week. There's one day off, and most of the girls still went to the gym on that day to work on their fitness. You know, classes starting on some days at 7:30 in the morning. I've often said Lawrenceville was this place of extraordinary privilege, but not indulgence. You know, everyone worked really hard. And then, of course, there was the obvious culture shock, which was extraordinary wealth, which in a boarding school, it seems counterintuitive because obviously just the fact that you're there shows that there is that there's wealth there, although many, many kids are on scholarships, you know, like me, which was very, very enriching because there were a lot of kids who frankly came from much, much poorer backgrounds than me, who were coming from inner city backgrounds which made my tiny farm in Ireland upbringing look quite privileged. So that was very eye-opening too. But there is something about being on campus whereby, you know, there was a little bit of a leveler there. And it was when you went off campus and I would go to friends' houses at the weekends or on holidays. I mean, it was, and then you would see wealth that like, it was just mind-blowing, you know, people whose parents were bankers or business people, all absolutely lovely to me. But it certainly, I tried very hard to go with it, but there were many times when I felt insecure. You know, I did feel as though, you know, I think a lot of scholarship kids do feel that way. They wonder, you know, whenever they make very close friendships with kids from very wealthy backgrounds, they kind of wonder how do those kids' parents view them? You know, do they want them hanging out with kids like you? And it was really one of the first, it was the first time in my life that I started trying to place myself there. I thought there was a strange knowing that I was a little coarser than the other kids. You know, I smoked cigarettes, not when I was at Lawrenceville, but I'd smoked cigarettes in Northern Ireland. I'd worked in a bar at the weekends. I cursed more than these kids. I had way more life experience. Like I felt my own self being a little rough around the edges in a way that I had never noticed before. And that was difficult and very eye-opening, to be self-conscious of yourself, and maybe in a healthy way, but maybe not.
One of the things, and I think, obviously, I'm an Irish immigrant. This year is 40 years since I arrived in the States. And one of my experiences was realizing that people were having a great deal of difficulty understanding what I was saying. So talk to me about accent, because I think accent crops up quite a bit in your book. And the necessity to bend it depending on the circumstance. So were you bending accent in Lawrenceville?
Massively. I think it's a bit of a taboo, you know, back home, to change your accent, you know, where we place so much, like rightly, we place so much, I think we place a lot of value in Northern Ireland and Ireland in particular on making sure that you, you know, remember who you are, you stay down to earth, you don't go changing, because changing yourself can bring with it a certain sense of morally, you know, flip-flopping, or maybe, you know, losing a sense of yourself. But and so I always was very aware that accents changing is often frowned upon. And I was also so aware in Northern Ireland that accent was very much so linked to class, you know, and so there was a real sense, and in the UK it's even worse, you know, across in England. So I think as a young person who didn't quite fit in where I was growing up, to put it mildly, like I was very much so trying to find a sense of myself, but in doing so, I was often just trying to fit in everywhere I went. And so I think I didn't have a strong enough sense of myself to not do that. And so, I was very, very keen not to stand out too much, in Lawrenceville. And, you know, because the reality was very often the very first conversation you end up having with someone is them asking you about your accent and then asking you about tomato, potato, potato, like, you know, and all I wanted to do was fit in. And so I ended up writing about this a lot in the book. You're quite right. Like I changed the accent to try to fit in, try to feel like I could belong there. And then I go back home to Northern Ireland to work in a chicken factory where very, very quickly I will not be speaking with this American accent, and, you know, and so on and so forth. And then I'm on camera desperately trying to get a job years later, and I'm told they only want American accents. So, like, you know, accent and identity and the sense of me trying to figure out where I can belong plays up a lot in the book. People ask me, you know, you have a much more of a transatlantic Americanized voice on camera. Is that on purpose? And you know, I very often respond and say yes, you know, because for once in my life I was openly asked to talk that way.
Yeah, I call my accent mid-Atlantic, and when you say you know, I hear the trill at the end of it from Northern Ireland. It's, you know, it kind of stretches out. So it's one of the few clues to me, you know, of where you're from. But I want to move forward now and talk about a pivot point, which took place in the odd location of a Dubai car dealership. Tell me about that.
Well, I've been lucky enough, you know, so I finished studying in Yemen and I really had no money left. Like I stayed because I was so in love with it. I stayed as long as I could. I also didn't have a plan. I had nowhere to go. So I was lucky enough to eventually get a job in Dubai at an English language newspaper, which was really very fortunate in the middle of the crisis in the UK and the US and media and Europe, everywhere. You know, the financial crisis, getting a job in Dubai was a real stroke of luck. And it was the Middle East. Like, it wasn't quite as adventurous and interesting and, you know, and incredibly intense as living in Yemen, but it was still the Arab world. So I thought, well, it's a start. So I'm going to go out to Dubai. And I worked on, you know, correcting spelling mistakes. I was a sub-editor on the sports section. So it was very much so the bottom of the totem pole in the newsroom. But I didn't care. Like, this was my first actual paying job in journalism. So it was a big break. And I was 24 and I, 23 when I moved there. And then I, less than a year in, I was made a features writer on the business desk. So this was my first time actually getting like a proper byline and articles published. And I was writing like full page spreads. And it was, you know, business journalism was not something I had aspired to. I'd grown up wanting to cover like hard news, all of the big like conflicts and peace deals and everything in the Middle East that was going on in Iraq and Afghanistan. But at least it was a paying job in journalism and it was comfortable, you know, like it was well paying. I had a really nice life. And so I worked on that for quite some time and until really it sort of came towards the end of 2008. And I had this growing sense that I was very close to where I wanted to be, which was, you know, working in broadcasting, working in big teams, being out at the front in Afghanistan and Iraq, but I wasn't quite there. And I didn't really know how to make that happen. I had applied for jobs, nobody was hiring me. And so I was basically living a life that I didn't really want to be living. It was a very nice life. It was a very nice job. And I lived a very nice lifestyle. It was quite glam and quite fun, certainly for a youngster in their early 20s. But I went to this Mazda showroom where, you know, it would have been part of my beat to cover like the car industry. And they were just releasing a new type of car. And I was only really sent because there were these Japanese executives coming into town. And I just had this moment, you know, I was standing there while they unveil this new car. And, you know, I'm standing there in my high heels and my little skirt suit. And I start to feel this sort of sense of absolute panic that says, this is going to be my life. Like, this is my career plateaued. This is as good as it gets. I'm not going to go anywhere else. And my dreams are going to die because this is so comfortable and I'm not going to move. And so, a lot of the car showrooms were further out towards the airport area, sort of on the outskirts of the city, although it's sort of all been swallowed up now. And so I knew Terminal 2 at the airport in Dubai used to be where all the flights went to like Afghanistan, Iraq, Pakistan, Yemen, everywhere. And I felt like I had to do something drastic. So I just got in my car and I drove to the airport because it was really at the airport where you would buy a ticket for like, you know, these sort of airline, the kind of airlines at the time that were flying to Afghanistan. And so I just decided I would just do it and figure it out when I got there.
Jane, you take some odd vacations, I must say. you end up in Kabul. We'd like to hear about the hotel you stayed in because it sounds like from a movie. But it seems that in that unlikely place with bombs going off down the street and bullets flying, that you found your tribe.
Definitely. And I mean, it's an incredible experience. Growing up dreaming of doing something and then suddenly finding yourself there. Because I pictured this in my head ever since I was a little girl. You know, reading everybody's biography and autobiography. And then I got there and I found that it was amazing. You know, there was this one hotel, a small like boutique hotel in an old, old house in Kabul. I think one of the last sort of remaining old colonial, like British colonial era houses. And they'd extended it out a little bit in the back and set up this big, big garden because, of course, Afghans are big gardeners, so they grow a lot of roses and beautiful gardens. And so it had a really big garden. And And as you entered there, it was just filled with foreign correspondents. It was sort of this really quirky guest house. And it was kind of mad and brilliant. And they had a bar in the basement that they turned into like a proper, like an old English pub. They'd brought in like horse brasses, and they had like, I mean, it was hilarious. It was just like you'd walked into a regular pub. And although, of course, it was all sort of like bootlegged liquor. So, you know, this was the Islamic Republic of Afghanistan. So you paid heavily for your drinks. It was quite a profitable business, I believe. And so and you know, all the rooms were sort of mismatching, and it was sort of a tongue in cheek Flashman novel theme to the hotel, which was, of course, it was called the Gandamak Lodge, and the theme, of course, being the last stand at Gandamak, which was one of the worst, perhaps the worst military defeats for the British in all of history, where the entire army was wiped out by the Afghans who rose up against British rule. And I think one man survived to tell the tale, and he was a surgeon. And so it's sort of legendary in British history. And it was, you know, there was an old cannon out the front. There were, you know, it was really brilliant and sort of strange and interesting. But the sense of camaraderie amongst journalists was like nowhere else. You know, you'd walk in there and everybody just ate together, talked together, drank together. It was very, very much so immediately a tribe.
Yeah, I think your account, if I'm correct, that you crossed paths with the legendary photojournalist Tim Page there, and how he basically kind of set you straight on war coverage, that it wasn't just about the bang bang.
Yeah.
Could you tell us a little bit more about that?
Sure. I mean, I was scrambling around for a story. I didn't really know, you know, I didn't know what to do. And someone had recommended that I potentially could go and interview Tim Page. He was in town. He's very, very famous. He's born in England, but spent most, I think, of his later life in Australia. Tim Page had been flown in by the United Nations to help train Afghan photographers. You know, there was a huge push in Afghanistan, and it was actually very successful, to train Afghan media, you know, to build an entire journalism industry and a generation of professionals in Afghanistan. And Tim was training Afghan photographers, and he is a legendary photographer who had taken incredible photographs in Vietnam and Cambodia. I mean, he's a really kind of like the Robert Capa of the UK. And I went to interview him just to do a simple profile for the newspaper in Dubai for their magazine section, and this supposed interview really just turned into him spending the afternoon giving me very straightforward and frank career advice. And, you know, I think that it had so much of an impact on me over the years. Looking back, I thought what I was going to do would be meet this swashbuckling, adrenaline junkie, this kind of wild man who was sort of tough and cool. But he was incredibly humble, and he was very dismissive of the bang bang. And this is for a man who had, you know, lost a piece of his brain the size of an orange to bang bang coverage. You know, he'd nearly died many times in the field. He is not afraid of war fighting and combat. But he gave me this long lecture about what real journalism is in war zones, about how we should really be covering, you know, not covering a war, but covering a country, covering a people, you know. And he starts asking me questions I don't know any of the answers to. He's like, well, how many people here are in insane asylums? Like, is there a mental health crisis here? How much does it cost to get married? Why do people here have these enormous weddings that they can't afford, and they go into debt, you know, for, you know, what about Afghan culture? How do people eat? How do people conduct themselves? He's like, you know, he said, like, we don't know about these people. And these are the stories of Afghanistan, and these are the stories that you really should be doing. And I thought, and I was suddenly kind of embarrassed, because I'd come in all excited with my new flak jacket, which had never been worn. And I thought that I was too much into the cool factor of war reporting. And he set me straight. You know, he said, he sort of helped me understand what journalism really was about. And it was in the middle of that conversation with him, and we're in this little porta cabin in the fortified UN compound, and he's smoking rolled up cigarette after rolled up cigarette and talking and talking and talking. And it was that moment that I realized that I hadn't really had a conversation with anybody yet about Afghanistan and journalism, you know, bits and bobs about hard news, like the elections and what might happen. But it was really more about the American soldiers, any upcoming surge, the Brits, what was happening in Helmand. Like, nobody talked about Afghanistan, Afghan people and Afghan stories. And so, you know, that conversation came at just the right moment in my career. I think if it had come a year or two later, I might have already been too much, you know, molded by my experiences in the industry. But he told me where to start, and that's where I've kept on going from.
Jane, it sounds like the conversation's kind of shifting now. It's been very fun up until now, right? There's adventures, there's excitement. We're shifting into what you were really doing and what you were up against. And there's a few words that crop up in the book repeatedly, and one of the strongest ones is fear. You describe fear as an ally. You describe fear as a colleague. There's a quote about the line between cowardice and carelessness and threading that line. Tell us about how fear was a good thing for you. Fear was a legacy. How did you manage it? And how important was fear in your next few years of your life?
A big part of the themes in the book were also pushing back against a lot of the romanticized, lionized versions of war reporting. And I've been commented to over the years again and again and again, wow, she is fearless. She's so brave. Aren't you afraid? You must be afraid. Like, do you ever get afraid? You must be fearless. And so a huge amount of what I wanted to help express is that fear is always there, you know. I mean, not 24/7, but doing this kind of work, doing work that is dangerous, involves making sure that you can kind of make peace with fear, you know, that you can understand it and that you can work and function and operate while it is present. And that was another reason that I wanted to keep a lot of my childhood experiences in, because I had such chronic anxiety as a kid. Of course, I didn't know that. I thought that's just what life was like. and I look back and realize I was an intensely anxious kid. The ability to function with fear is absolutely sacrosanct if you're going to work in dangerous places, you know. And what I mean by function is you have to be able to continue doing your work, doing your interviews, treating people with humanity, being polite, being organized, being aware, and doing all of that without panic. So I think that what I was learning as I was doing this kind of work, I learned it in Syria and I learned it in Somalia in those really early young days, was what I was learning was how to communicate with fear, like how to measure it. Is it panic? Like, do I just not feel okay and I just want to leave and therefore I'm going to, you know, surrender to that and go? Or is it smart, like in Syria? Is this fear actually telling me to pay attention, that this is too dangerous? And so a lot of the early young years are trying to figure that out. And what gets in the way sometimes is ego and self-consciousness. You know, I didn't want, like, you know, I felt like people might, I mean, I called that chapter, chicken shit early on in the book about working at a chicken factory, but it's meant to really be a kind of prelude to the later in the book, where I'm fearful of other people thinking I'm not brave. So I learned to get over that, and I learned to make friends with my fear and to trust it sometimes. And so this is all a game and a dance, and it's a very, very dangerous learning curve.
So let's just step back a little bit from fear. I think we'll revisit that again and talk about Jane Ferguson and her economic life, because the other thing that shines through this book, I kind of get the feeling at certain times, clearly you're spending your last buck to go cover a story. because you're freelancing a lot at this point. And so it's like, I need to go out, I need to get a story, I need to kind of bring that story back, package it up, and then shop it around, mm-hmm. right? There was no economic safety in your life for quite a long time. And the frustration of not being picked up by a network.
That was a huge, I mean, that really encapsulated the early years of my career, that I wanted people to understand that in the industry, in TV news, there is, certainly at the time, you know, I was part of that sort of real first generation of freelancers, but it was in part because, you know, getting into a network is very, 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 very difficult. You know, it's at the time, certainly with the financial crisis, most of us couldn't get in anywhere. And you're subject to all sorts of criteria, many of them pretty arbitrary. You know, where did you go to college? How do you, especially for women, let's be honest, how good looking are you on camera? And then also, frankly, you know, it's a smaller minority, but it exists. Do you have family connections? Do you know people in the industry? And so if you fall through the cracks on all of those and you just don't get hired, it is your only option is to freelance. And it is extremely difficult. If you're not of independent means and you're freelancing, it's extremely difficult to make ends meet. It's very, very hard. And at times, for me, I really, you're quite right, I was on my last buck. Like, I was spending any last, like, you know, couple of $1,000s that I had in my bank account to get to Somalia to get a story that an editor, a managing editor had at CNN had said they might be interested in. So, you know, and the reason I found myself in that position was because, you know, I hadn't been hired, but there was nothing else I wanted to do. Like, this is all I'd ever wanted to do since I was a kid. So I didn't have a plan B, you know. I'm not much of a plan B person, for better or for worse. So to me, I was like, well, I can either do this work and be broke, but love it, or I could go off and do something else that I hate for probably not very good money either, because I'm 23 and I have a degree in English and politics. So for me, I just... And I loved the work so much that I just had to keep believing that if I just kept going, I would somehow find a way to make a living at this.
Jane, you love the work. It shows through. You also throughout question the work. You wonder what the motivation is, what the value. You speak a lot of about responsibility in what you're doing, and the word service comes up. Could you give us an example of those impulses coming to play in a very human story you were able to relate that just wasn't told yet?
Well, the impulses, I mean, you encapsulate a lot there. I mean, I would say the impulse of service versus ambition, you know, calling versus ambition has been a tension, a sort of underlying conflict in my work a lot. And I still don't really have a resolution for that. I believe journalism is a service. I think that private corporatized media, there's always going to be a conflict of interest there between public service news and, you know, what are people going to want? The ratings, you know, well, how can we sell to advertisers? And within each journalist, I think that there is a sort of quiet conflict between your own ambition and your desire to do good in the world. And I think that being self-aware of that is very, very important to rein in your, especially in TV, let's be honest, to rein in your personal ambitions. You know, a situation where I experienced this most viscerally early on in my career was when I went into Syria for Al Jazeera English, huge break to be sent in. Of course, I was like, you know, the journalistic equivalent of cannon fodder. I was this kid, no one knew. And I was sent with like, you know, a massive wad of cash and a handy cam and a flak jacket. And here's some contacts of people and some shady guys in Beirut who can smuggle you across the border. Huge story. It had it all. It was massive part of the Arab world's history. A story where human beings, human rights were being trampled on, people were being slaughtered by their own government. It mattered enormously that the Western world and the wider world more broadly heard these stories, heard these people's experiences, especially whenever you had like a White House. I remember the Obama White House was unsure, like the Western world didn't quite know how to respond when the Arab Spring was turning into these really, really brutal crackdowns and eventual civil wars. So you couldn't think of a story that had more important human elements to it. That was a service, and that was a huge responsibility. Bearing in mind also that you have a newsroom behind you full of people who would take this assignment in a heartbeat. I'm not some special. I mean, look, there's a lot of people who wouldn't take it because it was extraordinarily dangerous, but there was a decent stable of reporters who would have done it. So for me to take that money, to take that assignment, to take that moment in time and those connections and to go out there and do it, there is responsibility. But you balance that as well against personal ambition, you know, and I questioned that when I got really a lot of sense knocked into me in Syria. That was the first time I really thought I was going to die. And it was the first time I really felt fear that was all encompassing. That's the first time I think psychiatrists nowadays call it existential dread, which of course I didn't know the phrase back then, but that was the first time I experienced that. And I don't recommend it for anyone. But I came out of that experience and I had met with these activists, volunteer medical workers, protesters, people who were putting their life on the line and who were most likely going to die. And many of them did afterwards. And this was before Marie Colvin went in, like a few weeks later, that same place, same media operations for the activists. And I did, you know, I was very shaken by my experiences and I had to sit down and have a conversation with myself. I was 27 at the time. I thought, did I do that out of ambition? Because it was a huge break for me. Or did I do that because those people needed me to be there? And the answer was probably, you know, hopefully mostly the latter, but there was a little bit of the former. And constantly questioning what your motive is became something throughout my career that was a thread that I'm not sure ever got entirely resolved, because I think there'll always be a certain inner conflict there, because the two of them can be at times countering one another. You know, and I sometimes worry about what TV news does to us when you're on camera, when you're under pressure, when you're ambitious, when you want a bigger career. But here you are in the middle of the worst day of someone else's life. And what's happening to them is really what this is about.
Yeah, one of the things that struck me about that particular serious story is what comes out is you kind of have a spidey, almost a spidey sense that, you know, we're not in a good situation here, because I think you thought the Syrians rightly were tracking satellite transmissions. And that seems to have been the case that led to the tragic death of Marie Colvin in that situation. So, but the other thing that you kind of mentioned at the top of that answer was the nature of news itself. I note you now work for PBS NewsHour, which is not-for-profit news. When I look across the spectrum of American news, having grown up in a diet of both Irish/British news and American news the last 40 years of my life, I gravitate towards the not-for-profit news providers. I think ProPublica does incredible investigative reporting. I think of Frontline and PBS. I think of NewsHour, which is a steady part of my diet, you'd be pleased to know. I think of NPR. So talk to me about... You've also worked for for-profit news, right? CNN and Al Jazeera. So talk to me about how you see that from a journalist point of view and looking forward. We talk a lot about, is journalism in crisis? So talk about the not-for-profit versus profit, because it seems to me that the not-for-profit is a much better home for in-depth, thoughtful reporting.
I agree. You know, my experiences were the same, right? I mean, I grew up as a kid watching the BBC. That's what I thought TV news was. You know, there were also RTE reports, but predominantly it was the BBC. It was Orla Gearan, Kate Ady, you know, and I write about that in the book. You know, I mean, like these were women that were like heroes to me as a kid. But my take on it is that I don't think you're ever going to have, I would never say all for-profit corporate media is bad. because I think anything that gets people, you know, talking, having conversations, literally being aware and engaged in the news is a good thing. But I think there will always be, as a baseline of standards, there'll always be a need for public broadcasting, because there's always going to be news that matters more than it entertains. And that's the, you know, you need to have a news source that is not for profit, because the editorial compromises, you know, are always going to be there in for-profit news. And that's fine, but not-for-profit news has to exist, because we have to be able to have a standard bearer of what is, you know, important news for people to watch and hear and read. And so what I'd like to see in the United States is that public broadcasting becomes and holds the ground, is genuinely centrist. You know, it has to be religiously credible in order to keep the hallowed position it has. But I'd like to see it becoming more the norm. Like the BBC in the UK, you've got Sky News, you've got ITN, you've got Channel 4, but you will always have the BBC as like a kind of news leader. And I'd like to see that more. I suspect we may end up there because, yes, we have a crisis in journalism. It's actually a very different crisis from the crisis in the journalism industry. Corporate, like journalism as a business, is in crisis, not public broadcasting. You know, public broadcasting continues to be extremely strong. So I think as private for-profit journalism tries to figure itself out, I think that public, you know, figure itself out from a business model standpoint, public broadcasting will survive and I hope thrive. There's always going to be a need for it, I would say, more than ever. I certainly hope it survives this leap online.
Jane, we've been fortunate to have some very interesting journalism conversations on Irish Stew, and the contributions of Irish journalists, people like Mark Little, who have embraced the digital side of the news business. And we hope to have Malachy Brown of the New York Times on, who's just doing amazing stuff at the New York Times. We've talked about Donny O'Sullivan a few times for what he brings to his reporting. So really, it's a topic we love to touch on at Irish Stew. My fear now is that we are out of time. I think Martin may agree with me, but we've never had an hour fly by sooner, but we know you have a train to catch. had we mentioned our good friend Seamus Plugg to you? Had we mentioned Seamus Plugg? Seamus Plugg is our feature at the end of every episode, where we allow our guests a shameless plug. Whatever you want to promote, your book, your website, something coming up in your world, a cause you believe in, tell us your shameless plug, and we will be sure to list all the pertinent web links in our story notes.
Okay. I'm going to pick two, if I may. First of all,
absolutely,
it is my book, No Ordinary Assignment, which I hope accommodates a lot of these kinds of conversations about all of these issues, because I've been terrifyingly transparent in my book. One last thing. On Thursday of next week, I am going to be giving a talk. Yep, Thursday, 21st of September, I'm going to be giving a talk hosted by the National Humanities Center of the United States. It's going to be at UNC Chapel Hill at the Nelson Mandela Hall, but it's also going to be available online. If you just go online and Google that, I'm going to be giving a talk, speech about American foreign policy and what I've learned in my years on the road, and then a long Q&A with a moderator and with those present. So register online for that, or show up if you're in the area.
Jay, we can't thank you enough, and we can't recommend this book more highly to our listeners, No Ordinary Assignment. When I say over the last hour, we only scratched the surface, that's an understatement. It is such a rich read, such a compelling read. Takes you to places you've never been before, and shines a light on things we should all be aware of and thinking about.
Thank you.
Martin, thinking back to our conversation with Jane, there's words that come up in my mind. Her generosity, well, generosity spending an hour with us, but her generosity in sharing her experiences with unflinching honesty, her openness, her constant examinations of what her own motivations were to do this kind of work, and the way she used fear as a balancing point for her career and her assignments, and her sense of service that permeated her work.
The one word that comes to mind in talking to Jane, especially about the earlier part of her career, is vocation. There was nothing else that she wanted to do. This was a calling. And she had the option of living a comfortable life. She was living a comfortable life in Dubai. She had a BMW. And then she drove her to the airport and went to Kabul because she wanted to do serious news reporting about important things. And that has driven her career. She's had difficulty a lot of times economically, but she has shown incredible persistence. So somebody at that stage in their career, taking the risk, following her vocation, and it's great to see somebody succeed to that degree and deliver important news stories that we all benefit from.
She's a multi-award winner, and I think there'll be more awards in her future and more great work. So stay tuned for more from Jane Ferguson.
Irish Stew is produced by John Lee, Martin Nutty, and Bill Schultz. Editing, mixing, and mastering by Bill Schultz. Music on Irish Stew was composed and performed by Rosa Nutty, with Donald Bowens on drums, Cathal O'Riordan on bass and synthesizer. For more on Rosa Nutty's music, please visit rosanutty.com.